Hello, and welcome to Seikahan, Global Reactions. Today, starting from the reclosure of the Strait of Hormuz, we look at what it means for a price tag to appear on the freedom of the seas. On July 12, 2026, Iran declared it was reclosing the Strait of Hormuz. The next day, the United States named itself the Guardian of the Strait. And it announced a 20% fee on all cargo passing through. That raises a single question. One country closed the sea, the other says it will guard the sea and charge for it. Which of them is breaking the freedom of the seas? There are three questions worth asking. First, why has passage through the strait always been free? Second, why would the side that is winning the fight start charging a fee? Third, who does this invoice actually reach? Starting from the reclosure of Hormuz, let's take them one at a time. First, let's lay out what happened. On the night of July 11, 2026, a container ship transiting the strait was hit near the stern. One Indian crew member was killed in the attack. The next day, July 12, Iran's Revolutionary Guard Navy declared the strait reclosed. It was an open-ended closure until further notice. This came after the United States had been carrying out airstrikes. Over three nights, from July 7th to 11th, U.S. forces reportedly hit more than 300 targets. The stated aim was to degrade Iran's ability to attack merchant ships. Next, the American move. On July 13th, President Trump made a declaration on social media. From now on, the United States would be known as the Guardian of the Strait of Hormuz. And on that basis, it would seek a 20% fee on all cargo transported through. The logic offered was that others should share the cost of providing security. But this declaration did not last. Within about a day, on July 14th, Trump reportedly withdrew the 20% fee. He said he would replace it with trade and investment deals from the Gulf states instead. The blockade of Iran's ports, however, went ahead as planned. So the toll itself never became policy. It stayed a declaration and then a bargaining chip. How did markets and international bodies respond to the declaration? Take Brent crude, the benchmark for oil prices. On the 13th, it jumped by around 9%. On the 14th, it touched about $86 a barrel at one point. Traffic through the strait thinned as well. On the 13th, only six merchant ships were reportedly confirmed transiting. That was the lowest level since the crisis began. And an international body raised its objection. The International Maritime Organization, the IMO. Its Secretary General said no legal basis exists for a mandatory toll simply for transiting a strait. Let's trace the road to this second closure, in order. It began in late February 2026. The United States and Israel launched large-scale strikes on Iran's military and nuclear sites. The Supreme Leader was reportedly killed in the opening strike, and the leadership was shaken. In March, Iran declared the first closure of the strait. But it granted passage to friendly states, such as China and Russia. This was less a blockade than a system requiring Iran's approval. In April, a ceasefire briefly held. But the U.S. also shut Iran's ports, creating a double blockade of strait and harbor. On June 17th, Pakistan brokered the Islamabad Memorandum. It framed a 60-day extension of the ceasefire and a commitment to safe passage. But the man who signed it was President Pezeshkian. The finger on the trigger at the strait, though, belongs to the Revolutionary Guard. The one who signs and the one who shoots were not the same. Then, in July, the memo collapsed, leading to the reclosure and the Guardian Declaration. So why has passage through the strait always been free? The key is the difference between a strait and a canal. A natural strait carries a right of transit passage. It is the right to pass without the coastal state's permission and without a fee. The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea guarantees this right. And the coastal state cannot suspend that passage. Only a charge for a specific service, such as pilotage, is allowed. The country beside a strait simply happens to sit there, in legal terms. A canal, by contrast, is a waterway dug by human hands. Tolls there have been accepted as payment for construction and upkeep. The Suez and Panama canals are the leading examples. The principle of free passage has a history of a price tag being removed. From 1429, Denmark taxed ships passing through the Sound at the entrance to the Baltic. This toll is said to have once earned 2/3 of the kingdom's revenue. After 428 years, the toll was abolished in 1857. A group of nations pooled a lump sum to buy out free passage for good. And the United States joined that buyout the same year, through a separate treaty. America stood on the side that paid to protect the freedom of the seas. The sea can stop even with no warships lined up across it. What stopped it was the loss of insurance and permission, not mines or gunships. Once insurers will not underwrite a ship, commercial transit no longer works. And this closure was not applied evenly. Iran granted passage to ships from China, Russia, India, and Pakistan. It works less as a blockade than as a system that runs on Iran's approval. So can the oil simply be routed around the strait? There are bypass pipelines, but their spare capacity is limited. Saudi Arabia and the UAE together hold about 2.6 million spare barrels a day. The strait itself carries around 20 million barrels a day. Only a little over a tenth of that can be diverted. How did people abroad take it? Let me sort the Reddit reaction by theme. The thread went up on a major world news board. In a single day, it gathered more than 18,000 points. The tone leaned heavily toward criticism and sarcasm aimed at the United States. I'll flag that lean up front and present it as it was. One line, this is, literally, a mafia-style shakedown. You can't collect protection money when you can't actually provide the protection. And a warning that, if enforced, the ones who ultimately pay are consumers. One format of joke was especially popular in the thread. It pairs a real quotation with an invented sarcastic one. Rubio, last month, no country may charge tolls on an international waterway. That first line is a statement he is reported to have actually made. Rubio, in the near future, it is not a toll, it is a payment for protection. That second line is the invented part, mocking a position that flips. And one more voice. This is a betrayal of a principle the United States upheld for 200 years. The point being that freedom of navigation is what has underwritten American power. Now we reach the heart of this video. Let's dig in from four angles. First, the idea of pay us because we protect it has a real argument behind it. This is the logic of user pays, and cost sharing here has a real logic. For decades, the safety of Hormuz has been supplied by the U.S. Navy. And the cost of that has been carried by American taxpayers. The beneficiaries were the buyers of oil. Take an importing country like Japan, which depends on the region for about 95% of its crude. Nearly all of it passes through this one strait. After the crisis, the bill has already reached consumers in importing countries. In Japan, for example, gasoline was held near 170 yen a liter, only through subsidies and reserve releases. So the invoice has already arrived in the form of taxes and drawn down stockpiles. But calling this simple free riding is too neat. Gulf states have paid by hosting bases and buying weapons. Japan has paid through host nation costs and its own intelligence activity in the region. Benefit and burden were entangled from the start. Second, but before that argument even begins, there is a legal wall. The Law of the Sea Convention does not allow a charge based on passage alone. The IMO agreed. No legal basis exists. And Rubio himself is reported to have rejected the idea before. No country, he is said to have stated, may charge tolls on an international waterway. This is the second time this year a charge by presidential fiat has hit a wall. In February, the Supreme Court struck down the president's tariffs, 6-3. The ruling held that the law gives the president no power to impose those tariffs. At home, the courts, at sea, the international bodies, keep drawing the same line. The United States has not ratified this Law of the Sea Convention. Yet it is a principle America itself has invoked across the world's oceans. So this reads as a declaration carving out an exception for itself alone. Third, why would the side that is winning start charging? On the tactical ledger alone, the American side is dominant. The airstrikes reportedly hit the very tools used to attack merchant ships. The port blockade has reportedly all but sealed off Iran's oil exports. There are two ways to read why a winner would charge. One is cost-sharing. Being able to say allies will pay answers to a public tired of intervention. The other is leverage in a negotiation. Open with a high demand, leave the details blank, and wait for concessions. And note what actually happened here. The fee was floated, then dropped for investment deals within a day, which fits the leverage reading. But either way, one thing holds. The premise that maritime security is free was rewritten the moment it was declared. Military dominance fades in time. The precedent of sending an invoice remains. Fourth, this invoice is addressed to the Allies. A 20% fee would fall mainly on Western and neutral cargo. The oil is owned by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, and Qatar. The buyers are Japan, South Korea, India, and China. The adversary, Iran, meanwhile, shields friendly states with a net of exemptions. The Guardian's invoice lands on allies, while the adversary protects its own customers. That inversion is more serious than the size of the fee. Oman, a coastal state, has reportedly drafted a plan splitting the strait into two corridors. It is a realistic exit, but it also formalizes a sea that runs on permission. And what is eroding is trust in an American-led order. The calculation becomes, then China may be easier to plan around. This is not a rise in trust toward China. It is a relative shift. The thing it is compared against has fallen. Let's bring this together. In 4.5 months, the Strait of Hormuz has closed twice. Each time, something was left behind that a reopening does not reset. Insurance premiums, detour costs, an approval net, and a declared security fee. It was Iran that closed the sea. But the first to openly put a price on the freedom to cross it was the side calling itself the Guardian. The two are enemies. Yet, from opposite sides, they are writing in the same premise. That passage now needs permission and a price. Finally, the question this leaves us. The 20% fee itself was withdrawn within a day. But the precedent that a guardian can name a price does not simply vanish. The strait will reopen at some point. Yet it seems unlikely to return to being truly free. And the world has many narrow waterways, just like Hormuz. The Strait of Malacca, the Turkish Straits, Bab el-Mandeb. The next time a similar bill arrives, the world still has no shared logic for refusing it. In 1857, nations pooled their money to buy back the freedom of the sea. When the time comes to buy that freedom again, who pays and to whom? That question stays open, even after the strait reopens. You'll find the fuller analysis and more reactions on our blog, Seikehan, linked in the description. Thanks for watching.